Well, it's a very good morning from me, John Fradgley from the Bell Legal Group, back with you for another program of The Law and You. As always, your opportunity to get free legal advice between now and 9:30. All you need to do is get on the telephone. 5520888 is our number. 5520888. If you're south the Tweed River, of course, 07 in front of the number, and you can always use our email if you're unable to get to the phone. talkback@4crb.com, and we will be able to deal with that question next week. Thank you to all the people who called in last week to make for such an interesting program. We had a mammoth number of calls, actually, which was really good to see, and let's hope that we get plenty of calls again this morning, because that's what the program is all about. It's providing advice to you on questions or queries that you may have, and hopefully helping a number of our other listeners out there who may not be in a position to call during the program. So 5520888 is the number, and you could be our very first caller for the program today if you get on that telephone right now. Now, last week or the week before, I was talking about just the wonderful job that the ACCC and ASIC, and in fact our also the Departments of Consumer Affairs in the various states take or make, the wonderful effort they make in endeavouring to control unscrupulous business. And it's incredible that despite the fact that the ACCC and ASIC have never been more active in the marketplace in endeavouring to keep people observing the law, there seem to be more and more incidents of unscrupulous behaviour, which is a rather sad thing to see. And I do have a few things that I will comment on in relation to that a little later in the program, but we have our very first caller online, as we say, a very good morning to Rose. G'day, Rose. How are you today?
I'm terrific, even better when you give me a good answer.
I hope so.
I know you do your best. I love your show.
Thank you.
So the situation is this. My partner for 20 years, we never lived together. He's 90, had a stroke, and I'm looking after him. Mm-hmm. He's with me now. That's besides the point. The situation is this. Some time back, he gave his four children who lives overseas, mm-hmm. 40,000 each as a loan. Centrelink is aware that that is his asset.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, if he dies, what's happening to that 40,000 on loan? What's going to happen?
Well, what do you know what his will provides in terms of his estate, where his estate is to go?
He made the will. He got four children, mm-hmm. as I said, and they got 40,000 on loan.
Yep.
And I, in his assets, I'm included as the fifth person mm-hmm. to share his assets.
Okay. So am I correct in saying that the estate effectively gets shared five ways? Is that right?
Correct.
One share to each child and one share to you. Okay.
For children mm-hmm. and one share for mine.
Yep.
The purpose of this call is those that already, his children, four of them, got 40,008 mm-hmm. on loan.
Yep.
That's the question. I haven't got that.
No.
That's the question. That's the purpose of this call.
Yes. So let's say, for example, that his estate consists of $200,000. So that's five times $40,000. So the children, having already received $40,000 each, their entitlement could be offset against the loan funds they've already received, and the remaining $40,000 would be paid to you as your share of the estate. If the estate was worth $400,000...
It's $350,000. His whole estate that he sold the property, all he has is $350,000.
$350,000, and that includes the $40,000 each that he gave to the four children.
That is plus the $350,000. His only property is $350,000. That's in the bank, earning hardly any interest.
So, how much does he have in the bank?
$350,000. $50,000.
Okay, and he's given each of the children $40,000.
But that is good. That might have happened about 2, 3, 4
yeah,
years.
Yeah, doesn't matter when it happened. So if they've been given $40,000 each, and I understand that, and the estate consists of $350,000, then that for each child, that $40,000 would be taken off their share of the estate. So that $160,000 would be added in. So if he's got $350,000 now, that $160,000 would be added on. So what's that take it up to? $590,000. So you would divide that by five. $40,000 loan to each child would be deducted off the share they'd get, and they would only get the balance, and you would get your share. So it will all be done equally. Okay, then?
Okay, I appreciate your call.
Okay, Rose.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Time on 4CRB is moving along. It's just past 12 and a half minutes past 9. The Law and You is the program, 5520888, the number. As we say, a very good morning to David. G'day, David. How are you today?
John, I'm really well, except I'm in cold old Sydney at the moment, and it's pretty cold.
Oh dear, so are you listening to us on the World Wide Wireless?
I've been doing it for quite a while, John.
Excellent.
I first came across the station when I used to visit my dear departed aunt. She lived at Kingscliff.
Oh right, and lovely part of the world.
It is, and it was her favourite station, gave her a lot of comfort, and So I was sort of forced to listen to it. I just really love the station. So,
excellent.
Yeah, I'm on the internet, yes.
So how can I help you today, David?
John, last week you mentioned binding or nominations in relation to superannuation.
Yes, binding death benefit nominations. That's
correct, yeah. And yep. It raised a question in my mind because I've got forms in front of me from my superannuation fund that need filling out. When I've spoken to the helpline, they haven't been very helpful.
So, it's a bit of a misnomer, isn't it?
It is, rather. Yeah, so I'm just wondering, you know, one of these forms says binding or non-binding death benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's another one that says reversionary death benefit nomination.
Right.
And there was another one, which is the one I actually sent back, which was just really simple, just needed one signature and a tick. So I forgot what that one was. But my question is, what's the difference between these?
Well, your question would probably be better posed to Finance Forum on a Thursday, David.
Oh, okay.
No, that's quite okay, but I'll give you a little bit of advice. So, because without seeing the forms, it's always a little difficult. But the one about the reversionary pension, that's normally where you're going to pay a reversionary pension, for example, to your spouse on your passing so that your superannuation will continue to be paid to your spouse as a reversionary pension. The binding death benefit nomination or the death benefit nomination, there are three types. There's a death benefit nomination, which if you're in an industry fund or a retail fund, and indeed in a self-managed fund, they're not binding on the trustees of the fund. So the trustees of the fund can basically take note of what you've said in the death benefit nomination, but they can still exercise their discretion as to how they'll pay the super. The second one, the binding death benefit nomination, is, as the name suggests, binding on the trustees. And particularly in most retail and industry funds, they have to be renewed every 3 years. And then the third one that you haven't mentioned but may or may not be available is what's referred to as a non-lapsing binding death benefit nomination, which is one which, as the name suggests, once you've filled it out, it remains in force forever until you change it. So they're the three types. I'd be double-checking about the forms, David, because my experience has been that just about all death benefit nomination forms require you to sign, and they require the witnessing of two independent witnesses at the same time. So I'd just be double-checking to make sure that whatever you've sent in is what you intended. So it might be worth... Are you in an industry or retail fund?
I think it's a retail... It's one of the large funds.
Yes, okay. So it's probably a retail fund. So I would just give them a call and just... Because you've sent the paperwork in, just to double-check with them what the effect of it is. And if you've unwittingly sent in the wrong form... then you can always, of course, send in a new one, which will sort that out. But just double check about the witnessing, because as I say, all of the particularly binding death benefit nomination forms I've ever seen require two independent witnesses.
Okay. Mm. Yeah, the two forms that I've got left both require two witnesses. The one I sent in just required one signature, and I think it was the last form you mentioned, the lapsing, the non.
No, if it was a non-lapsing one, I'm sure it would require two signatures. I suspect it might have just been a death benefit nomination, which is one where it's an indication to the trustees, but they still have a discretion how they're going to pay the super. So I would definitely be following it up.
Okay, and when you say that the trustees have discretion, what does that mean?
Well, what that means is that although you may have put in a death benefit nomination which says that I want 100%, for example, I want 100% of the death benefit nomination paid to my spouse. If they were, for example, and this is a true life example that I had some years ago, if they were to discover that you had previously been married and you had an infant child from your previous marriage, then the trustees might exercise their discretion and say, no, we're not going to pay all of the money to your spouse, as you've said, on the death benefit nomination. We're going to pay some proportion to your infant child of your previous marriage, and we're going to pay the balance of it to your spouse. So that was actually a true-life example that I had some years ago, which caused a huge amount of angst in this particular family, because no one had any idea that there was in fact a child. The second wife had no idea there was a child, and sadly she was pregnant with their child when the husband was killed.
Oh, dear.
So it can be a devastating situation. He had apparently made provision for that child in terms of the property settlement and everything after the first marriage ended. But notwithstanding, the trustees still have that discretion if it's not a binding death benefit nomination. So that's why a binding death benefit nomination, be it lapsing or non-lapsing, is the way to go. Non-lapsing, in my opinion, is the preferable way to go, because it means that if you accidentally forget about it and don't renew it, it doesn't simply expire.
Okay.
All right.
So just one final question, if I may. So that means that your nomination could be contested, like a will can be contested?
Yes, they can, and it goes before, I think it's called the Superannuation Review Tribunal or something, that that will hear those disputes.
Okay.
Mm. But if you've got a binding death benefit nomination or a non-lapsing one, I don't know that they're capable of being contested.
Okay.
All right, then.
Thank you, John. That's been most helpful.
Okay, David, all the very best. The time on 4CRB is just past 19 minutes past 9. The Law and You is the program. 5520888 is the number. We've got open lines there at the moment, so if you have a question or a query, you get on the telephone right now. We'll be back after this word from our sponsor.
Have you got old jewellery, coins, banknotes or stamp collections just taking up space and collecting dust? You need to speak to our trusted sponsor, Jeff Yates. Jeff will give you the very best price for your unwanted collections and jewellery, and will even come to you in the privacy of your own home. Jeff has over 35 years' experience in this business. Call now on 0412 11 32 11 to arrange an appointment to give you the best price.
And this is The Law and You on 4CRB. Our telephone number, 5520888, if you have a question or a query. We've only got time for a few more calls, but the lines are all free at the moment. So if you have a question, get on that telephone right now, 55208888. And while we're waiting for that, I was talking earlier about the wonderful things that ASIC and the ACCC are doing, and a couple of examples of those were recently a swim school franchisor was ordered to pay $23 million in penalties by the federal court for misleading and deceptive conduct in relation to offering swim school franchises to franchisees. And the good thing about that, of course, is that, and what I wanted to emphasize to those of you listening today, is that if you yourself or you have children who, because of the issues that have been thrown up in our working environment through COVID, are looking to alternatives for ways of making money, and franchises, of course, are one of those. The overwhelming advice that I would give in relation to this is to make sure that you or your children don't cut corners in looking at these issues and just look at them through rose-coloured glasses, accepting that they're going to get, they're going to make hundreds of thousands of dollars. It is definitely money well spent to get not only sound financial advice, but also sound legal advice as well. But we have another caller online. We'll say good morning to Murray. G'day, Murray. How are you today?
Hello, John. How are you?
Really well. How can I help you today?
John, Advanced Health Directives.
Yes.
Are they, if you have one in Queensland,
yep,
which I believe has been revised to 2020, my original one was back in 1980-something.
Right.
Now, the Advanced Health Directive, is that valid in other states if it's signed in Queensland?
Well, the Advanced Health Directive for Queensland is specifically for Queensland.
Right.
And not every state in Australia has the equivalent of the Advanced Health Directive. But it's my understanding that if you make that document known to the health authorities in the state that you're going to, then there shouldn't be any difficulty with them observing it. So, for example, if you are going to be moving from Queensland to New South Wales, what I would be doing, I mean, one of the first things you do if you're moving residents is that you look for a new doctor, and I would be taking the Advanced Health Directive along to the doctor and just saying, look, I'd like to ensure that this is followed in the event of me becoming terminally ill. And so can you just tell me whether this document is okay or whether I need to do a new one? And alternatively, is there anything in the health system in New South Wales where I can get this document recorded as part of my health records, so that if I go into hospital, for example, if you move to Ballina and you go into hospital down in Wollongong, is there some way that this document can be on the state records, so that the information contained on the document will be known to any hospital that I may be admitted to? All right, then.
My question is more aimed towards grey nomads,
right,
which I've won.
Right.
Travelling from different states.
Mm-hmm.
As far as South Australia.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way we can lodge that on the MyGov site.
Look, I'm not sure. You'd have to check with your doctor, Murray. So if you go to your doctor and just check with them whether that can be recorded on the MyGov site, they would certainly be able to tell you. But failing that, what I would be doing is just carrying a copy of the document with you, so that if you do have to go to the doctor, you've got the document there with you amongst your records.
Yeah, it's more of a concern when you get knocked over tea, and you can't talk to anyone.
No, that's true.
True.
But so what I would suggest you do is take it up with your doctor to see whether it can be recorded on MyGov. I certainly know that they record them on, I believe, on the state system, so that if you get admitted, for example, to the Gold Coast University Hospital with an Advanced Health Directive, they do note on their records that that you have one, and I believe that's then current right across the state. But as to whether that's just specific to Queensland or it's done through MyGov, I honestly can't tell you. But if you speak to your doctor, I'm sure you'll be able to find the answer. All right,
then. It's a vibe bill, isn't it? Okay, thank you.
Okay, then, Murray, all the very best. And the time on 4CRB, 25 minutes past nine, as we say a very good morning to John. G'day, John. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm well, thanks, John. I have a question on superannuation, John.
Sure.
I am in my 80s, and I subcontract to a contractor who is required to pay me superannuation, I understand, which he agrees with. Is there any requirement as far as age goes that you have to have a superannuation fund? In my case, I don't have one.
Right, okay. No, look, I don't know the answer to that, I'm sorry, John, but if you were to call Finance Forum on Thursday, same time, so at 9 o'clock that program comes on air, they would certainly be able to provide you with an answer to that.
Thank you very much for that.
Okay then, John, all the very best. Well, that's probably about all the time we have for calls today. If we have someone out there who's got a quick question or a query, you'll be able to get straight through. So, so please do so. While we're on the subject of superannuation and probably trust deeds more generally, one thing that we have noticed over many years as we review documents for estate planning is the number of times that the trust deeds for superannuation or family trusts, the chain of documents is incomplete, particularly where there have been updates to super deeds, for example. And one of the things that needs to be looked at very carefully is the power to update that is contained within earlier documents. Quite often these updates to super deeds are done through bulk suppliers of documents and often are done by accountants. But if the original super deed has a particular form that is required to be followed in relation to updates and you don't use that form, then the subsequent update can in fact be invalid. So there's an old saying that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. So the moral of the story here is to make sure that you do have your super fund documents, your super trust deeds and any variations of that, and indeed your family trust deeds and any variations, check to make sure that there are no weak links that are going to make the documents ineffective. We probably have time for one last caller as we say good morning to Wayne. G'day, Wayne. How are you today?
G'day, John. It's Wayne White here. Wayne. I have a question. We have a demand for payment an estate. We've sent this along to the administrators, but they're in no position to pay it. If we pay it, what type of receipt should we get that the claimant has no further call on the estate or on us if this account is paid? And we may use the material which relating to the services rendered.
Right. So basically what you're saying, are you the executor of the estate or the administrator of the estate?
No, I'm not.
All right. So the situation is that the estate had a debt owing to someone at the time that the person passed away. Is that right?
No, it was after the person passed away. It was the services rendered after the person passed away, and at that time the administrators were appointed, and subsequently there's been two other appointments after that. But the estate itself, we know for certain that there's no financial position to pay any other debt than the necessary ones, and they don't count this one as a necessary one.
Right, okay. So I don't quite understand then why anyone else would want to pay the debt. If there's no money in the estate to pay it, then...
Well, we feel obligated that we should pay it on behalf of.
So what you're basically wanting to do is you're wanting to basically buy the goods, and from effectively you're wanting to buy. So the goods are in whose possession?
In our possession now.
All right. Okay. Well, it needs a three-way agreement, Wayne. It would need to be an agreement between the administrator, between you as the buyer, and between the person who supplied the goods, to say that you're going to pay for it, and everyone agrees that the goods will then belong to you.
Okay, then, and they can be used, and this is what we want from the buyer, that those goods can be used at us at any other later date?
Yes, well, you'd need to include that in the agreement, that the parties agree that you're entitled to the goods and that you can use them as and when you see fit.
And we should send them a letter stating that before we get a receipt of
You definitely need to get that agreement in writing. There's no question about that. And quite honestly, Wayne, I think I'd be getting, depending on the value, I think I'd be getting some legal advice on it to prepare that document for you before you actually go ahead and present it.
Yeah.
All
okay,
right then. Okay,
thank
Wayne.
You.
All the very best. And that's all the time we've got for today. John Fradgley from the Bell Legal Group, great to be with you this morning. I'll look forward to being back with you next week for another program of The Law and You. But as always, until then, goodbye and God bless.